I'm Bob Stivers. I teach ethics at Pacific Lutheran University. I'm a Presbyterian, not a Lutheran. And sometimes people ask me how it is that a Presbyterian should be teaching ethics at a Lutheran institution. And the true story goes something like this. True story. Several years ago, when Pacific Lutheran University was looking for a person in Christian ethics, I got this phone call. And the gentleman on the other end of the line said, Bob, would you come out here and look at this position? He said, we searched the entire Lutheran church and we can't find anybody that had it. That usually goes over better in Lutheran crowds than does in Presbyterian crowds. And of course, you know that's the truth. I have a case study that I'd like to start with, and then I'd like to reflect on it after we've discussed it for a few minutes. The case study goes something like this. This is an actual event. It seems that a group of snowmobilers, some of you may have read this in fact, this is not too many years ago, a group of snowmobilers was snowmobiling in Yellowstone Park, needless to say, in winter. It's a group of 9 or 10, and the leader was a chief executive officer of a major U.S. corporation. He was noted both for his command style and his sensitivity to things of nature. It seems in the process of snowmobiling in the park, they happened upon a bison who had attempted to cross a stream and had broken through the ice and was trapped in the broken ice and the rushing stream. The CEO stopped. It was not clear in the case whether or not the snowmobilers had spooked the bison to try to cross the stream. Purposes of the discussion, let's not assume that. Assume that it had gotten there by natural means. Well, the bison was stuck and the snowmobilers came along and they stopped to see what they could do for this bison. And it just so happens that a park ranger, who in this case happens to be a woman, but it's not relevant to the case, happened along soon afterwards, and the CEO, who had taken command of the situation, said to the park ranger, "Get some help." And the park ranger said, "No." And the CEO, who was somewhat taken aback by this because he was bent on rescuing this critter, said, "I would like you to call back to your headquarters and see, get some help." And so she called back, and the rangers at the park headquarters said, "No." First question, that's part A of the case, we'll come to part B. Should the park rangers have come to the assistance of the bison, or indeed, would you have in a similar situation?
No.
Why not?
It's a natural phenomenon.
It's a natural phenomenon. Okay, there's one response to it, that it's an item of nature, and thus we should not interfere with it. Other opinions? Yes?
Well, in the wild, I think it would be a natural phenomenon, but within that setting,
The natural park is supposedly a wild area. It is winter when there's not the mass of tourists that manage to invade Yellowstone each year.
Well, I know what he's saying.
What is he saying?
I guess I would help whether I thought it was right or not.
You would help. Why?
Because I don't think I could stand to see it suffer.
So the suffering of the animal is, in one hand, juxtaposed against the let nature take its course.
If I was in Africa, I think I'd be more inclined. I don't, for some reason.
If you were in Africa?
Well, I don't know. It just seems like a national park is less warm than
Okay. Other opinion?
Well, it seems like if a bison had gone through the ice, that a snowmobile with somebody on it would probably go through the ice, or there'd be danger to anybody that would try to help a bison is probably going to be uncooperative.
Mm-hmm. Presumably, the National Park Service had within its capabilities some better means than trying to run a snowmobile into a stream. I don't know. That's not a given in the case, so I don't know. Yeah?
Once you get your bison out, what's your obligation to cure the bison of the probable injury and pneumonia that he's got now?
Oh, I don't know. Assuming he or she just managed to fall in shortly before and was healthy, a healthy beast. The only problem was that the ice was stuck in the ice. Yeah?
Because I want to assist the this, even though it wasn't a natural phenomenon, if I happen to run into something like that, then that, I like to feel that I can affect natural phenomenon, you know, that I have some power there. Although in this case, because it's such a big animal, I wouldn't want to risk my life or the life of other people to do it. So it'd have to be, you'd have to have the equipment and the expertise ready to do it. Otherwise, I'd want to shoot the animal.
That's very interesting because in this case, it's a positive intrusion into natural ecological systems. You don't like negative intrusions, but you're willing to take positive intrusions. Is that right?
Yeah, although I guess I'd want to know more about it because sometimes what people think is positive intrusion turns out not to be positive.
You think this is a positive intrusion?
I'd have to do more reading about buffalo first.
Do you think this is a positive intrusion?
What is it?
To say the bison, it's intruding into a natural system.
I think it might be a negative intrusion.
Might be a negative intrusion, right?
Yeah, I would want more information. I mean, I want to know why the park rangers won't help, but there must be a reason.
There's a policy in the national park.
Why?
The same policy is to let the park burn.
Just to get it back to its natural state.
Natural. They're attempting as much as possible. And again, a national park right. with tourists introduces a unnatural setting, which may be a qualification in this case, but in the dead of winter, it's much less so. And it was not that they were spooked by the snowmobile.
I'd be worried it might turn into a media event like the big whale rescue a few years ago.
Actually, it did, because the CEO, when he went out, was upset, to say the least, and he made a big issue of it. That's why it got the news. Okay, part B. I'm going to give you a taste of this debate. We're not trying to settle it here. The CEO and his buddies decided that they would try to extricate the bison from its suffering, and they managed to lasso the horns of the buffalo and tried to pull it out with a snowmobile, but in the process it became clear that they were not going to succeed. The bison was stuck there, and there was no way they were going to get him out. So it just happened that the ranger had a gun, I'm coming back to you, and the CEO said, "Shoot the bison," and she said, "No." And so they called back to the headquarters, and the headquarters said, "No."
No.
Why?
Same policy.
Same policy.
Protected species.
And yet the other side of the coin is what?
It's going to die.
It's going to die, and in the process it's going to die. What's it going to do in the process? It's going to suffer. Well? Will it suffer? Is suffer a category that animals undergo, or is that a human projection onto animals?
Animals would feel, they'd have nerves,
mm-hmm.
and
pain.
They feel.
Suffering is an interesting word. I've never explored the word suffering in this case before. I don't know what it means for an animal to suffer. Humans suffer. Animals feel pain, so do humans feel pain, but I don't know. Pain and suffering are exactly the same thing.
If this had happened over the hill and nobody had noticed it, would it still be suffering then?
I just defined pain as suffering. So no matter which side of the hill he was on, there would be suffering.
You'd shoot him.
Well, at first I wanted to try to get him out if that worked.
No, it's not possible in this case. And the park rangers refused to make an attempt. Mm. Because of park policy.
Isn't it also possible that the animal in some possibility might free itself?
To
its own devices.
Sure. In this case, part C is that it didn't. The temperature goes down to 20 below zero that night. The animal dies, freezes.
They say hypothermia is a nice way to go, though.
Is that right? and the carcass remains frozen the entire winter, and come the thaw in the spring, several animals are seen to be feeding on the carcass of the dead bison.
Then that's natural.
It's natural. I'm really pushing this case fast because I want to get to the analysis of it sooner or later. If the animal was a cow, that was a beef cow of a farmer from a range just north of Yellowstone Park, would you protect, save that animal?
Maybe the farmer would say that.
Would you? Or would you just let nature take its course in that case?
Yeah, looking at me, I couldn't do much with the cow.
Well, presuming that you had, had the possibility, you had the necessary equipment and you knew how to operate it.
Well, then I think I would help the cow.
Would you help the bison?
I would if I could, yeah.
Okay, all right. Is there anyone who would not help the bison and would help the cow? What's the difference that I'm trying to get at?
I think there's a reason for that point of view, which is the cow's a domesticated animal. It's ill-equipped to deal with the natural world, and the human was part of making it domesticated, so the human will extend the responsibility to save it, whereas the buffalo was not domesticated. So
a cow has financial value.
Well, now they're making beefalo burgers. I guess maybe bison does too. I don't know.
Well, the cow, the difference isn't simply in a historic relationship between human beings and cattle. It's between that farmer and that cow. That cow belongs to that farmer, and so there's a sense of proprietorship.
Yeah, but if you weren't the farmer and you
if
came across...
the farmer, then I would try to find the farmer.
But you would believe in trying to save the cow, and would you believe in saving the bison too?
I think there's a sort of parallel between asking the ranger, who in a sense has responsibility for the park and its inhabitants, and asking the farmer, who has responsibility for the cow. So in both cases, it's sort of not assuming authority.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But collaborating.
Mm-hmm. I'll take the position, save the cow, leave the buffalo.
Why? You state your position succinctly.
Because the cow has been domesticated, and as a member of the human race, I have, let's say, I've been part of the domestication of the cow and left it ill-equipped.
So it's a part of human culture, in effect.
Part of, right. I've taken some responsibility for the cow being fat and ungainly and unable.
And actually in that place at that time.
Right, because it's been bred for either meat or milk.
And put on that range.
And somehow it escaped here into the wild from my domesticated field, so I will be responsible for pulling the cow out of there. But I won't take the buffalo because it's in its natural habitat and it's sink or swim.
What
about
the human
culling?
That's a natural occurrence.
Well, yeah. Human's part of culture again.
I mean, I'd help anything.
You'd help anything.
All right.
So you would intrude into natural systems.
I'm seeing the death of the buffalo is not necessarily bad.
Intruding into natural systems.
No, I'm seeing the death of the buffalo is not necessarily bad.
The buffalo is thing.
Well, that's an interesting observation. Is the death of the buffalo bad?
I'm just seeing that that's not necessarily
it certainly
bad.
Isn't in a larger perspective.
To take our thinking further, if we hadn't made the national parks, the buffalo wouldn't have been there, so we've been free to begin with.
We would
already
wipe it out.
Oh, okay. Well, Rick, one or two more, and then I'll try to do some analysis.
The park position is a little odd. I mean, they hardly have a hands-off policy for all the animals, as it is. I mean, they're very active in the managing of the bears and moving them to save them from people and save them from having to kill them.
They try to do as little as possible. But we might transpose this to a wilderness area, say, where there's almost no intrusion.
Except these dumb CEOs on motorcycles.
actually, if you really want to know the truth,
we're in the park.
The truth of the matter is that about 96% of our wildlands are now have been severely interfered with. That doesn't mean that there aren't wild lands, but they're been severely modified by human kinds of actions. There's only about 4% of the wildlands in at least the continent, lower 48, that are really truly wild anymore. Very interesting fact. Well, now let me try to do some analysis of this. I figure it's one job when an academic like me, one of the responsibilities we have at Holden is to try to do a little thinking about this for you. So that's what I'm going to try to do. This is some stuff that I'm just putting together. I appreciate your reactions in the midst of it. I will rattle for a while, and you feel free to interrupt me if you will. I don't have to finish what I'm doing, but I'm going to start what I'm going to do. What I want to explore is the thesis that there is a difference between culture and nature, or natural systems. There is a distinction, but not a separation. And I want to eventually get to the point of trying to see how it is that we are to relate or should relate to nature at the same time that we are part of it, yet distinct in some way from it. Now, I want to start with a word analysis. I want to start with the word integrity. I'm going to approach all these questions from several directions. And this is the first one, the word integrity. I'm approaching it this way. My path was started on this because the World Council of Churches has been undertaken for the last 5 or 6 years to talk about the concept of the integrity of creation. Those of you who have been at all familiar with environmental discussions are aware of this. Now, what's interesting is what the origins of this word are. The origins are the Latin word tango, which means, does anybody here know? Yeah, this is a trivia question. What? No? It means to touch.
I heard you. I gave you credit.
Who said that?
She said touch, right here.
Well, how'd you know that? You're Latin?
Play me conjure it.
What?
Don't touch me, I belong to the king.
Good. You get a gold star and at least 50 points, at least one triangle in your Trivial Pursuits square for tango, touch. Now, that doesn't immediately give you any understanding of the word integrity, I don't think. But if you look at the past participle in the Latin, the past participle is the word tactus. Now, what word, if you add a preposition, a certain preposition to that, what word do you get in English?
Intact.
So, intactus means intact. So, integrity means, has something to say about intact. It doesn't mean untouched, not in the sense of, we don't want to say that something is, that's, we want to touch people, and that's a good. But what we're getting at here is to talk about something that's intact, untouched in the sense of being pristine, undisturbed, not disintegrated, something that's integrated or whole. That's the word we're getting from the word intact, and so we get integrity means some sort of sense of wholeness or unity. Other words are integrated, integer, and a whole series of words pointing to a oneness or unity of things. Now, if we apply this to our problem, I think we come up with some interesting possibilities. On the one hand, I want to talk about nature's integrity. What does it mean to say that nature has integrity? Well, it seems to me, taking from this, we want to talk about the wholeness or unity or the untouched. In fact, sometimes we talk about a wilderness as being untouched, very closely aligned here. And I would suggest to make the analysis brief that to talk about the integrity of nature or the integrity of creation, at least the natural part of it, is to talk about the integrity, the wholeness, the unity of ecosystems. Insofar as possible, after all these ecological systems that we have, many and varied, have evolved over millions and millions of years, and they're quite capable of proceeding in the further steps of evolution and taking care of themselves if we just leave them untouched. So the integrity of nature is somehow to leave them untouched. And I assume that that's the basis of the philosophy of the National Park Service, is as much as possible to preserve the natural integrity of systems. Okay, now, the problem is, just a few corollaries here. I would suggest, first of all, that when humans destroy natural systems, that they violate the integrity of nature, the integrity of those systems, or the integrity of creation. We cause disintegration, if you will, and it seems to me that's something we would like to avoid, and so we leave the bison alone. Now, secondly, I would suggest that we are part of natural systems, and hence, in part, human integrity involves preserving of the natural ecosystems, if no other reason, for selfish reasons, that is to protect ourselves as a species living within that system. So part of human integrity is that of being part of a larger ecosystem and trying to intrude as little as possible. It's not possible for any species not to intrude in its ecosystem. After all, it is part of the system, and we are part of this system. But we also would want to suggest that there's something about human integrity, that is to say, there's something different that we can distinguish between human culture and natural systems. There's more to human integrity than merely being part of an ecosystem. There's something distinctive about human integrity. Now, what do we know from philosophy and theology about human integrity? Well, first of all, from the Greeks, the Greek idea of integrity was part of an understanding of virtue. In the Greek, the ancient Greek, classical Greek understanding of virtue, it included not only integrity, but courage, and there's a third of the triumphant nobility. I'm not going to worry about courage and nobility here. But for the Greeks in this tradition, there was an ideal of integrity, which meant a knowledge of truth and a refusal to betray the self. Knowledge of truth and a refusal to betray the self. And a character of a person's integrity was measured by comparing them to a rational ideal. And so your character was good if you measured up, and not so good if you didn't. In essence, I think the understanding of the Greek tradition is knowledge of, I'm going to write some of these down, knowledge of, and let me get my notes to be clear. I'm going to have to put my glasses on. Loyalty to truth. And loyalty to truth. Knowledge of and loyalty to truth, if we could summarize this. To have integrity, thus, is to have an integrated or unified character, one that's consistency between the knowledge and the truth and the loyalty, the action which follows from the knowledge. Now, so human wholeness, if we can turn to the word integrity, wholeness is that, knowledge of and loyalty to the truth. Now, if we look at the word wholeness, though, or unity, in the Christian sense of that word, we have a slightly different understanding. In the Christian sense, it's not how we measure up to a rational ideal, but human wholeness in the Christian tradition comes in a relationship of faith to God. Wholeness is a gift, salvation by grace alone, which comes in relating through Jesus Christ to God. So the tradition is not so much a measuring up to an ideal, but a gift, a power that is received through grace. And Christian character is measured by the faith relationship, not by any kind of measurement of an ideal. Now, if we could put these together in terms of human integrity, I'll summarize these. Well, synthesize these first. Say three things. First of all, that human integrity involves a knowledge of and loyalty to the truth, from the Greek, knowledge of and loyalty to truth. And secondly, it involves an intention to act in harmony with the truth. And thirdly, that the power to do this from the Christian side of the tradition, power through God to do the truth. Okay. Or if I may summarize that, is the common definition that you get out of the Dictionary of Human Integrity. This is the everyday Webster dictionary definition. It's the harmony, human integrity is the harmony of act and intention, where intention is knowing the knowledge of and loyalty to the truth. So a harmony or a consistency of act and intention. Now, if you can see, if I may summarize what I've said so far, is that there is a natural integrity, which is the fit of a species into an ecological system. But with human understanding of integrity, there's this an element of intentionality or knowledge. Knowledge and intentionality, which makes us somehow different than the integrity of nature's natural systems. So those two are distinct, yet not different, because, of course, we're part of the systems. Now, the question, finally, with this concept of integrity is, how are these two related, natural integrity and human integrity? And I would suggest two things. It seems to me that one of the elements of integrity, of relationship, we talked about faith as a relationship to God, is our relationship to nature. That is to say, one way we are related to nature is that one of the vehicles through which God approaches us is through the natural. So one avenue or vehicle or avenue of human wholeness is the appreciation of or the participation in natural systems. So we are related through being, we are made whole or unified, or we get to our integrity by being part of the system. And that means respecting it, respecting the natural systems. And I think the other way we are related is by knowing the truth, which in this case is the truth of the integrity of natural systems, that is their viability, their wholeness, their unity, their intactness, knowing that truth, and intending to respect that truth. So part of human integrity is knowing the truth about nature and respecting that truth, respecting natural ecosystems. In the case of the bison, I fully agree with your perspective, which says that we should, for better or worse, respect those natural ecosystems insofar as they are natural, and where there are intrusions already and we cause the suffering of animals, then we should intrude in to prevent that suffering. But insofar as it is a natural natural system, we are respecting the integrity of that system by not intruding in the plight of the bison. Now, that's my understanding of integrity, integrity of creation, integrity of human. They're distinct, but they are linked. We participate in natural systems, yet are distinct. Now, let me proceed. What has also stimulated my thinking here at Holden is the theme of the Holden summer, which is the image of God. And I haven't heard these words, image of God, around here too much in the last 4 days, so I decided to take it upon myself to reflect for a moment on how the theme of the summer, image of God, might inform what we're doing. Then I want to raise some rather tough issues for the whole enterprise. From our understanding of integrity, we know there's the distinctive element is something about human knowledge and intentionality. The tradition has labeled the distinction between human beings and nature as the image of God. That's the tradition has said that the distinction, somehow the distinction of human beings from the rest of the creation is that we, this species, is made, alone made, in the image of God. Now, the tradition means two things by the image of God. One is a set of endowments or capacities. We've mentioned in our analysis of integrity a couple of those. The ability to know, that is, rationality. We've talked about intentionality, which involves some element of freedom to intend. The process of valuing, we could go on and cite a number of capacities or endowments which the tradition has said make us distinct from the rest of the creation. Endowments. There's a second meaning, And by the way, if you want to know in a particular context which of these meanings is being used, you have to really investigate the context, because some people just throw these things out willy-nilly. The second is an understanding of the image of God as relationship. So, Adam and Eve were in the image of God when they were in the Garden of Eden before the fall. When we are related to God, right related to God, not wrongly related to God, which is judgment, but we are in relation to God, we are said to be on what?
Sin.
Unknown. This really is the start of something else, but I'll just keep numbering. Sin. Now, what happens with sin? Well, it's quite clear that with sin, our endowments remain. We still are rational human beings. We still have at least a limited capacity to intend. There is a little limited freedom. Freedom, of course, is never total, but there's a limited capacity for freedom. And so the endowments remain, but what happens according to the tradition with the relationship? The relationship is broken. The Adam and Eve fall away, if you will, from the relationship to God. So the endowments remain, the relationship is broken, so that the endowments are used for wrong things. One theologian has likened it to a chess game, where before the fall in the Garden of Eden, the players are in have their shapes. The king and the queen have a certain shape, the rooks, the pawns, and so forth. They have their shape, their individual capacities. And before the fall, all the players are located on a chessboard in right relationship to each other, each one moving according to the rules of the game. The fall is something like someone coming along and taking the chessboard and going like that to it, and with all the chess players over on their side. They're still in their same shape, their same capacities, but somehow their relationships have been broken. So the element of sin here is something to break it. And finally, of course, is the element of redemption, which means, of course, the restoration of right relationship and, indeed, the corresponding right use of the endowments. That's, after all, what, in a nutshell, the tradition is trying to say about sin and redemption. So the restoration of relationship, sense of the image of God, and the right use, a change from the wrong use to the right use of the endowments or capacities. And the model, of course, is Jesus Christ. Now, what is the significance of this analysis for what we're talking about tonight? Well, again, I would suggest that the tradition has been very explicit. There is a distinction between human beings and the rest of the creation. In fact, the tradition has emphasized that distinction to a tremendous degree, and to the neglect of the rest of creation. In fact, redemption has been almost solely a God-human relationship, having nothing to do with nature. But one of our relationships, I want to suggest, one of our relationships is to the natural. And one of the relationships that's broken in sin is our relationship to the critters, to the plants, to the animals. So that, indeed, we do intrude on nature's integrity, and perhaps the best way to see that is in the ancient coin of human sin. Now, it would seem to me that if this is true, and I would like to hold that it is true, that one element of redemption is the restoration of our relationship to nature. It must, it seems to me, include this relationship as well as the God-human relationship. So that we have to be concerned when we talk about our theology, not just about God and human beings and humans in relational terms, in terms of the image of God, but the human natural relationship. And fourthly, I think that we've got to reassert a doctrine of redemption in terms of the relationship of God to the rest of the creation. Somehow, we have subsumed the whole natural world under an understanding of creation in the tradition. That is, God created it and sort of let it go, and except for a few passages which are kind of nice about nature, we have pretty exclusively excluded any further God-nature relationship, and I think that's a shame. So we've got to, it seems to me, start talking in terms of God redeeming the whole creation. Indeed, there are parts of the biblical witness that talk in those terms. Now, I just want to raise a question about what that may mean. There's a lot of theologians today who are, I'm not original in saying that what we got have to talk about is redeeming the whole, God redeeming the whole creation. But what does it mean to say that God will redeem the whole creation? And I've been very interested in observing what theologians have been saying about that, and it seems to me there's a lot of confusion going on. Most of them, and I think probably they're wise, is to say that God will redeem creation, and then they stop and don't see it anymore. But some want to continue on. And it seems to me one thing that is clear about God redeeming the rest of creation, that the what will end will be excessive or disintegrating human intrusion. Part of the redemption of the creation means a ceasing of the human intrusions into nature which cause disintegration. Now, by the way, I want to say that some intrusions into the natural are not disintegrating. I see no problem with those. But some theologians go on to say that, and this is where I get puzzled, maybe you can help me, because I haven't been able to figure this one out, that, well, for example, they take the Isaiah passage where the lion will lay down with the lamb, and say that in the redeemed period, the lion and the lamb will exist side by side. Now, my problem comes in this, is what's the lion going to eat? I presumably will stop eating in the redeemed period, but if the creation is in fact good, so that, and this has some point with the bison story, so that animals eat animals, they use animals, we eat animals, whether you like it or not, we eat plants too, and I don't think there's a huge distinction between the two, but you may find that. What does it mean to say that the lion will no longer eat the lamb if, in fact, the creation is good, so that the demise of that bison in that system is not an evil, I don't think, but, in fact, part of a good system? It's hard for us to see death as part of a good system, but, in fact, it is. Our death, I think, is included, however hard that is for you and me to take, but it's part of a good system. God created us to die. God created the world good, hence we are participating in a good creation when we die. Maybe it'll make you and me a little less afraid of it as a result, I doubt it, but it might help. In any case, what does it mean precisely to say the lion will lay down with the lamb so that in a redeemed creation that this sort of thing will cease, particularly with the doctrine of creation which talks about goodness? Well, I throw that one out for your consumption. You may want to reflect and talk to me about that in private. However, that is a problem. I want to continue on to another problem, which I think is far more serious than that one, because I guess I'm one of those theologians that would like to stop with the notion that God redeems creation and not worry about what that means in terms of lions eating lambs, or humans eating lions or lambs together. I want to go on to the question. The important question is, since we are made in the image of God, since we have a distinctive integrity which differentiates us from the other critters, does that make us superior? Let me put that in the form of a question. That we are made in the image of God, that we have a distinctive integrity, not a separate integrity, but a related distinctive integrity, does that make us superior to the critters? What do you think?
Well,
I will. I'm going to get to that. Why did you tell me first? I hate that. The teacher gets to ask the question. You give the answers. Sorry. No fair. You know the rules of banking education, don't you? Okay, Diane, try that.
Well, I think if I look at the Genesis 2 creation account, where I think it's one of the places where the relationship between humanity and the earth is clear, although it's been obscured by certain ways by translating Adam as a name rather than when we were visiting class, I'd always say to students, this means earthling. You know, here is an earthling, an earth being made out of the earth. Then to talk about being superior suggests a sort of linked system. So yeah, maybe superior, but not superior I don't want to say dominant, but that's too valuing in this context. Not in a irresponsible way, but mm-hmm. superior in a heavily responsible way.
That's essentially where I will carry the discussion. So, good. I appreciate that.
Two simple thoughts. One, certainly in certain ways, it's clear that we have superior endowments.
Not all superior endowments.
Right. But it's also clear that many animals are extremely more endowed in certain other ways.
They're faster, bigger,
faster, bigger,
stronger.
They can fly. Okay, that's one. Yeah. So that's A. And B is whether or not we're loved more by God is simply mm-hmm. an unknown. I mean, we assume that we are. If we're talking about relationship and a core of relationship and love, then I think we're making an enormous assumption that we are loved, suffered for, and suffered with more by God than God does with other animals. And there's no particular way to prove or disprove that, but I think we make that assumption.
We make that assumption.
That we have a special relationship of affection by the Creator.
Yeah, but I think so, but I don't know whether I would understand, I'll come back to this, whether I would understand that as more love but rather something else, which I'm to admit.
It's just kind of dawned on me in all this talking. Maybe we as humans don't so much feel ourselves superior to the animal, the nature, but separate from it. I mean, I just think about how we struggle to go against the natural order of things. In medicine, for instance, I mean, women who would die in childbirth now, this is very infected. Many of us maybe wouldn't be here today if it weren't for medicine. I mean, look what we do in our cities to try to keep nature back. We pave the areas, and maybe part of that is the fear of death kind of thing.
Well, how does this relate to superiority?
Well, as I'm saying, maybe it isn't that we feel superior to nature. Maybe we feel separate from nature, uh-huh. and thus we don't want to be concerned with these environmental kind of things because it's not a concern of many people.
I was just reading today, just along these lines, there's several magazines in the rack out here called Creation-Centered Spirituality, which many of you know quite a bit about. And Matthew Fox, who's been one of the really important figures in that, was saying that he was in an interview, and one of his statements was that human beings are, and the critters are equal. That was his assertion. Any other observations on superiority of human beings? Yeah, Rick. Oh, and I missed. You had your hand up first, well, so let him get in.
I was just thinking a little bit about the issue of loyalty as opposed to, you know, maybe not valuing man, but loyalty to our species. That some of the issue about would we save a bison, we wouldn't even question saving a person. Maybe it's like species loyalty or something.
I think that's almost inevitable that we will, whether or not that's God's will or so I don't know. One of the interesting questions is it really evil that, say, a person gets consumed by a bear? Certainly it's no intentional of a bear to do evil. I mean, it's part of the system. After all, we're part of the system, and we're prey just like anybody else. That's an interesting question. Any other comments on before I try my hand at this superiority question?
Maybe look at what humans do to the earth.
Oh, Rick, I want to come back to.
Maybe humans are kind of inferior to animals if you look at
what we do to the earth. I think that's an important insight, which I'm going to use. Mm-hmm. Very important insight.
Getting back to the point I was just made here, we certainly think we're superior, and we certainly value human life more than any other life. Now, whether we can get at some, get outside of our brains to see some other standard of superiority is another question, mm-hmm. but within the way we think of ourselves.
Every species, in a way, has an instinct for species and self-preservation. I think both. So that's very true. Let me try my hand at this. First of all, in terms of whether we're superior, I suspect, in a factual sense, yes. As you, who was it said over here? yes, we are in certain things. I think rationality and those other things of incentive endowments we have, there's a D in that, incentive endowments that we have a certain superiority. We're not quite sure. Some people are suggesting some of the animals like dolphins and so forth have a well-developed cranial capacity. But so far as we know, we are superior to some endowments, but we're not superior to others. And I suspect that, well, let me just say that I think that's really very important. This is sort of an aside from the superiority question, because I want to repeat something that I said the other night, is that it seems to me with the emergence of these endowments in particular, as opposed to strength and flight and other endowments that other animals may have better than we, it seems to me, as an aside here, that something's going on in the history of creation. I'm not quite sure what it is, but I think it's extremely important that finally has evolved in a species in this particular evolutionary system. I don't know what other evolutionary systems there are. I presume that someplace in the millions of stars with planets circling that there is some kind of life, but have no knowledge of it. But in this system, something is happening with the emergence of these endowments, which is very important. I don't want to say that it makes us superior right yet, but something very, very important is happening, because for the first time, this particular creation is reflecting upon itself, is self-conscious. An element of the creation has developed a certain limited freedom, which to me is something significant, not something that we should hold as a particular element of pride, but to suggest that we're involved as a species in something that's very, very important. The consequence of yet which we have no idea yet. We may blow it apart in our freedom, but then again, the evolutionary process may carry this to some undisclosed sort of way, which of course is the Christian hope and some understanding of the second coming. So let me say that as an aside, that the emergence of these endowments is very important. But think about it for a minute. It isn't the endowments even that are the things that it seems to me make us superior. Certainly they don't make us superior in a moral sense, or it seems to me in the eyes of God. Just the fact that we have certain endowments doesn't mean that they are more valuable, it would seem to me, or particularly good. In fact, we know that these endowments, from our understanding of sin, can be used for very diabolical purposes. In fact, what makes us so nasty a critter is the fact that we can use these endowments to create all kinds of havoc. Adolf Hitler used rationality to create one of the most inhuman regimes the world has ever seen. We have created our rationality, which heretofore we have prided ourselves, particularly with technology, which is one of the modern technology is seen by some as progressive and as the highest reach of the human rational capacities, but we are also using it to intrude in an unprecedented way. Snowmobiles in the case is a case in point on natural systems. So it seems to me that in no way can we say that it is the endowments which make us superior. It seems to me we have to tend to this notion of relationship again and understand that, of course, in sin, relationship is lost and endowments are used wrongly. But the matter runs deeper. It seems to me that our true superiority, if we can talk in that sense, again, I want to at the end say I don't even think this is the right way to talk, but if we can talk in terms of superiority, then it seems to me that way we are in fact superior, if we are, is in terms of the right use of our endowments, that is, on knowing and doing the truth, that is, on maintaining our particular human integrity. And these, in turn, it seems to me, the right use of our endowments rest on right relationships, in particular to God and to other human beings. And thus, what really makes us superior is the right relationships leading to right acts, or leading to integrity. And that's what our superiority, if it is a superiority, in fact, really is. But now we get to a real problem in the Christian tradition, that the model of right use. Indeed, the power for right relationships, the power of right relationships, comes from God and the cross and resurrection. And the model for how we should do right relationships comes from the model of Jesus Christ. And the model and the power are radical in their dimensions. The gospel turns things topsy-turvy. The rich become poor, the poor become rich, the strong become weak, and the weak become strong. And so it seems to me things get turned upside down, so that in fact the question of superiority is the wrong question. We are only superior when we're not superior. We're only superior when we serve, not service for its own sake, but service to bring people back into right relationship. So superiority, to ask the question of superiority again, or even to claim superiority, is again an element of human pride and sin, not an element of a redeemed life. So the question is not whether we're superior, but indeed what is our right relationship to nature and to each other. A dual kind of right relationship in terms of our relationships here as in our experience and worldly existence. So we are right superior only when we serve, when we're not superior only when we are in an act of service. Let me conclude. Is that clear now? So the superiority question, what I'm trying to do is turn it on its head and say that that's not a good question. But if we understand image correctly in terms of relationships, if we understand human integrity and how human integrity comes from the act, the power of God, and it is modeled in the life and ministry of Jesus Christ, that we have taken on a radically new dimension of service to God, service to other human beings, justice that is, and service to the created order, which means, I think, some sort of protection, stewardship, or so forth. Let me pause here. I've got 5 minutes and see what your comments are. I've got two or three things else other, but they're short, and if I don't get to them, that's all right.
When you talked about superiority, that kind of implied a hierarchy, and I think we as human beings pretty easily get ourselves in hierarchical thinking, and it seems to me if we're talking about right relationships, we're really pushing us to think about the entire cycle.
I still want to say, though, that there is... I'm not going to throw out hierarchical thinking entirely. I think we are distinct from the rest of creation. I think an adequate theology both has to account for that distinction and yet account for the part of us that's part of the creation. So when we do a circle, it just, depending on what the circle means, it may say that the only thing that counts is our being part of nature. But I think that distinctive quality adds another dimension. But I guess I like to throw out pyramids and, I don't know, circles. But I would like to transpose the superiority question into one of the weak become strong, the strong become weak, and the power, which isn't the foolishness of God, is false. Right?
Two other dimensions of this distinctiveness of humans and the rest of creation. One is that humans have the capacity to live in virtually any ecosystem on the planet, underwater.
You do that with technology.
But even without technology, on a very primitive level, primitive societies have survived in virtually every environment on the Earth's surface without large-scale evolutionary change in our bodies. That would make us different from most other creatures on the Earth. The other thing is we have a much higher capacity to alter the environment at a much more rapid rate than any other creature.
Okay.
I would take your last concluding statement a bit further. Mm-hmm. And beyond stewardship, there would even be, and this would be turning it upside down even more, I think, is listening to and learning from the environment and from nature.
I think that's part of the relationship of human beings to nature. If you're going to have a relationship, it seems to me that you both speak to, Stuart, and you listen from, receive the power of nature. Good.
This is all very interesting. It all seems to me rather heavily weighted towards a Western cultural approach to the environment. I mean, if you take a look at the Native Americans that were here for thousands upon thousands of years before the arrival of the white man, do you see the same problems there? Or you see
I'm not an expert on Native American culture. Yes, this is a white Western perspective. I'm trying to reflect on my tradition as it impinges upon these. I think it's very important to listen to the Native American culture. And I think in most cases there you have anyone can set me straight on this if I'm wrong, less emphasis on the distinctive, the elements, these endowment elements which set us apart or make us distinctive.
I guess the problem that I have is when we start talking about humanity, it's as though we are taking, as a Westerner, I'm as guilty of this as anyone else that I see, of ruling out all these other avenues of approach, all these other lifestyles, all these other...
No, that's not my intention. My intention is to reflect on my particular tradition and to understand this perspective as one that's coming out of the white Western tradition, that I'm a white male. I'm a white male may add my the own particular nuance that I have a certain way of looking at this too. I don't mean to rule out anything else.
No, I didn't mean to imply that. I think we need to fold some of these things in. Mm-hmm. Because when we talk about how humanity relates to the environment, we're throwing away some of the groups of our own race.
Mm-hmm. Our own I don't mean to throw away, and Carla was doing that some of that the other night by trying to pull in some of these other elements, and I think that's it's very good. But I think we also have a response. At the same time, we pull those in, have a primary responsibility to reflect on our own tradition. Yeah.
The natural conclusion and implicit in what you said is that what makes us truly distinctive and superior is that, as far as we know, we're probably the only species that can sacrifice, care for, and be stewards, surrender ourselves in some sense for the care of others, and maybe that's a
I would hope that's what it, if we talk in those terms.
If we use those terms, it's mm-hmm. precisely that upside down gospel way of seeing. We're the only ones that we know of that make ourselves servants to other species.
Diane?
I want to go back to the second point there under the image of God. It seems to me that at least some interpreters of creation accounts have really been emphasizing in the relationality part of our being made in God's image, not simply that we're in the image of God because we're in relationship to God, but that we're in the image of God because we require relationship with each other, that it's impossible to be human alone. And so I'm wondering if we might extend that mm-hmm. to this third and fourth component of redemption that you've been talking about, and simply to say that if relationality is crucial to being human, that the relationality is with several different sorts of partners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. That's good. I'll talk to you some more about that. It's helpful. Yeah, Rick.
As you continue to think through this, the only other thing that I was concerned about is in your talking about integrity with respect to creation. There's a tendency to make that integrity of an ecosystem sound pretty static, and yet it's important to realize that change is an inherent part of a whole environment and any ecosystem.
Yeah, I'll amend what I say then to say that when I talk about an ecosystem, I mean the integrity of it is it's in its evolving characteristic.
And so in a sense, to take a piece of land and preserve it as a park and keep that ecosystem exactly the same in perpetuity is, in a sense, a violation of its integrity.
But to keep it, to leave it alone, which I think is not, keep it static is not the national park philosophy, but it's to leave it untouched so that it may evolve as it will.
No, it doesn't really work out that way.
Well, I understand, because again, I think that we've, as I said, 96% of the wildlands in this country have been intruded upon. Only 4% are left, and so it's very difficult to find it undisturbed, this integrated kind of ecosystem.
The popular interpretation of preserving something is to keep it the same.
Yeah. Another thing I would point out is, I think something I mentioned the other night, just because we intrude, that's a harsh word, because we enter into ecosystems, that entering in is not always negative. I think I said the other night the example of two places that one was set aside as a bird sanctuary and one as a human community, and before they had roughly the same number of species, but after many years had gone on, the one with the human community had twice as many species as the sanctuary did. Very interesting. I mean, there was a symbiotic relationship between humans and the critters that were living within. I mean, you look at it right here, the chipmunks. And I don't know whether that's good or bad. I won't care to comment on that. Okay, we're finished for this evening. Let me again...